The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
The title of the lead New York Times editorial this morning had a deja vu feeling. Darfur, Another Year Later, was the title. It reports, this is what the International Criminal Court prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo told the UN Security Council last week about Darfur. Genocide continues, rapes in and around the camps continue, humanitarian assistance is still hindered. More than 5,000 displaced persons die each month. How can this still be? The piece ends, still it might be worth delaying if Mr. Bashir, Sudan's cynically obstructionist president, called off his murderous militias, stopped obstructing deployment of a strengthened peacekeeping force, and began serious peace talks. The world is waiting. In the meantime, large-scale military attacks against populated areas continue. Only 10,000 of the promised 26,000 UN peacekeepers have been deployed. We're all hoping, I think, that President-elect Obama will make good on his promise to take strong action to end the genocide in Darfur, but right now, still, it's Darfur, another year later. As I mentioned, this is the last Aloud program of 2008, and I really do think this is the right program for the holiday season, because there's really nothing more important than opening our hearts and our eyes to what is happening to our fellow human beings. What brings us together tonight is a new anthology, Out of Exile, Narratives from the Abducted and Displaced People of Sudan. In this collection, the narrators tell in their own words stories of sadness, hardship, and resiliency. These are the stories of real people beyond headlines and hand-wringing editorials. They bring the situation home, and hopefully they will move us towards action and away from complacency. The narratives in this remarkable volume are published by McSweeney's, and they were compiled and edited by Craig Walzer, who is here with us tonight. Craig has traveled extensively in Sudan, Kenya, and Egypt. He's working towards graduate degrees from Harvard Law School and the Kennedy School of Government. Craig is joined by Panther Allier, a native of South Sudan, who displaced from his home by civil war, walked with many other young men, the so-called Lost Boys, across Sudan seeking safety in the refugee camps of Ethiopia and Kenya. Years later, he made his way to the United States, and he now studies. He's a graduate student in sustainable international development at Brandeis University. He's actually heading to Sudan very soon to do work for several months, and he'll tell us about that. Our third guest tonight, and she is a last-minute substitution for Elizabeth Ross, who just came back from Sudan and was not feeling well. Rana, we're very happy to have her. Rana Linto-Twala is a Sudan program officer with Relief International. She's worked with Relief International for 2 years, and she just returned from spending a month in Sudan, where she visited Relief International's Darfur and South Sudan programs. Craig Panther and Rana will take your questions after the presentation. We really encourage a lively dialogue, and we'll have microphones circulating. So please wait until the microphone comes to you so that we can hear you, and because we do record for podcast. Afterwards, the books are for sale in the lobby, and Panther and Craig will both be signing. So please join me in welcoming our distinguished guests to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for coming. So I'm Craig and
Panther Alia.
And Rana Linto-Twala.
And so we're going to spend the evening talking a little bit about the project that Panther and I were working on and about the situation in the country of Sudan more generally. And just to kind of get it started, this book, Out of Exile, that's just in the process of coming out right now, I'll tell you a little bit about how I came to the project, what we were trying to do with the project, and set some background for so we can talk in a little bit more detail about the basics of what's going on in what is a overwhelmingly at times complicated place at a very, very complicated time. I worked in Sudan for the first time a couple of years ago, I guess in the summer of 2006, doing some work in the capital city of Khartoum with a small Sudanese development organization called SUDO, the Sudan Social Development Organization, and also spent some time working in Cairo, Egypt, with a refugee law clinic that services what is an enormous refugee population, specifically of Sudanese that are living in Cairo. And I, the year after I spent working there, I was at university and met a man named Dave Eggers, who was on campus talking. This is a library, everybody knows who Dave Eggers is, I guess. But I bribed a friend at the school newspaper, and she got me a chance to sit down with Dave and with Valentino Achak Deng, who was the subject of Dave's book called What is the What? About Valentino's life as a child running away from the war in Sudan and then living in refugee camps in Ethiopia and Kenya and then moving to the States and his life here. I sat down with Dave and Valentino. We got to chatting and got along, and Dave kind of broached the subject and said, do you want to do this book? We've been thinking about doing this oral history collection for years and years and years. I said, okay, and they flew me out to San Francisco, and I was working with McSweeney's Publishing House on this book, which is part of their their Voice of Witness series. The Voice of Witness series has started as an oral history project to get stories of human rights of victims of human rights violations from their voices themselves. So books in the series have included this book called Surviving Justice, about exonerated prisoners in the United States, people who were found guilty of crimes that later turned out they were innocent of, and what their experience was being falsely incriminated and spending time in prison in their life afterwards. A book on the residents of New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, and then a book called Underground America that recently came out about undocumented workers in the United States. So this is the fourth book in the series. And it's a nonprofit work, so all of the proceeds for the book are going back into creating other volumes for it, and some of the funds for this are going actually to the Valentino Achak Deng Foundation, his foundation where he's working to rebuild schools in his hometown in South Sudan that he fled when he was a child. But when I sat down with Dave and we were talking about it, the original idea behind the book was to speak specifically with former slaves, people who in the country of Sudan during the civil wars there had been abducted and as a weapon of war. This was a very common tactic during the North-South Civil War, specifically women. And so Dave and Val originally approached me and said, well, we want to do this book on abducted. And I said, that wasn't so much the realm that I had the most grasp of, but what I suggested in response was, why don't we do something on displacement as a common thread throughout it? And this is to sort of explain to you why I think this is an interesting lens through which to look through it is the very basic story of Sudan. It was a British colony until 1956. It gained independence. The borders of Sudan, it was the same drunk old white men who brought you the map of Iraq, who brought you the map of Sudan, basically. It's this pretty weirdly shaped country, the largest country in Africa. Within its boundaries, there's something like 400 different distinct ethnic groups that live, speaking several hundred different dialects of language. And they were sort of forced together artificially during the colonial period. When the British pulled out in 1956, they left the power, the halls of power, the guns, the money to a small group within that, a few tribes that are in the north in Khartoum, and said, you're in charge, see ya. And when you look at it, so there's this small group that are in power, have been since 1956, basically, and they look and have much more ties to the Arabian Peninsula, to the Arab world, than they do to their fellow citizens to the south of the country. The northerners speak Arabic as their common language. They're Muslim. They're lighter skinned. It's the Sahara Desert in that part of the world. And then you have in the south of the country, you have folks, well, that are like Panther, it's a largely Christian population down there. And their languages are tribal languages, Dinka, Nuer. Arabic was sort of artificially imposed upon them. They don't have very many common cultural practices at all, but they were smushed together, along with the Darfurians in the west and Eastern Sudanese, who had a completely different economy. So 1956 comes, this small group takes the country, takes reins, and proceeds over the course of the next 50 years to cling desperately to that power and control over what are very scarce resources in that part of the country, as other parts of the country and groups in other parts say, hey, what about us? We want our peace. We want our piece of the pie. We want some access to political representation, to practicing our traditions and way of life as we have known them. And that's the very basic dynamic of what's gone on in Sudan in the 50-some-odd years since. Now, what this means in practice is that Sudan has, for almost all of its existence, with a few years there in between sort of failed peace agreements, Sudan has almost always been in some sort of civil war. And over the course of those wars, millions of people, they estimate like in the 3-4 million range, have been killed. Many, many more have been forcibly displaced, which means they had to leave their homes because of violence. And so when you look at the one thing that all of these diverse peoples within this country of Sudan have in common, it's really a living memory of violence, is that everybody knows somebody or has some story that they can tell of a time when they either had to leave because they were scared or were under threat or something along those lines. And so when we talk about it, you know, it's very common in the news. We have a distinct Darfur story. We have a distinct South Sudan story that was much more in the headlines a few years ago. But these are really very connected. And it's important to be able to draw those connections in the story and also to see what the people's experiences in this terrible way, suddenly there is this common reference point. There is a common experience of what Sudanese, unfortunately, what being Sudanese kind of means. So that was why we chose to approach it, and all of the narrators whose stories are told in this book, the one thing that they have in common is that they have had to flee their homes or have been taken, abducted from their homes in some way. The other part of it, I think, that it brings to light that isn't always clear enough, or I think something that needs to be appreciated more in the context of a Western audience like ourselves, is that we read a lot. Darfur makes the headlines, and we know that this is a place very far away, and we know that it's really bad there. There are like starving children in faded old American T-shirts, you know, and you have those kind of very distinct media memes, right, of suffering Africans, and then you hear about the various factions that are fighting against each other, and it's tribal conflict, and we have, you know, like, we hear these things every few years, something like that pops up, and you get a good story in the New York Times that sort of explains that, and maybe a couple minutes on the nightly news where you hear somebody talk about how their village was burned, but what happens in these situations goes on much beyond, way beyond just the sort of hygienic, nicely packaged moment of war or like couple of years of crisis. It's really a rendering of it tears the social fabric in a way that is not always easy to encapsulate in a small piece of journalism, but takes place over years, over decades, over generations. And one of the best ways to actually see that play out is to follow somebody's life. And so that's what we kind of did here, is I trekked around with a short little white guy with his big sexy data recorder and met up with folks in Egypt and in Kenya and in Sudan. And Dave and Valentino also did some in the south of Sudan. And we interviewed some folks who have been resettled in America also. We spoke to all of them and basically said, tell me your life story. And that means, let's start with where were you born? And what did your village look like when you were a child? And what happened next? And what happened next? And then eventually within that, of course, something very bad happens. And then life goes on after that as well. And we wanted very specifically that moment, what happens afterwards when you have, you know, when you're out of what the camera frame normally is focusing on, after the village is burned, what happens next? So these are, it really is tough. Let me just to bring this a little bit back down to earth. I think it's probably wise to give you a couple of details of what this actually means. A couple of folks are going to read a couple of excerpts. One of them was a guy named Benjamin, who I interviewed in a camp, an IDP camp around Khartoum itself. So Khartoum, the capital, is a couple million people, and then there's a ring around that city itself of about 3 million people who are living out in the desert in tents or plastic sheeting or mud brick homes. And these are people who have fled the war, fled from the south of Sudan during the civil war that was there in the 80s and 90s, people who have fled from the war that's been going on in Darfur since 2003. And there are 3 million of them who for them the easiest escape was to go to a city. They come to Khartoum, the only big city in the country of Sudan, and that's within earshot of the central office of power. And they're there, and they're looking to Darfur in the west, and they're looking, and they're saying, well, what about us? Like, where's the aid that's for us? Because there's so much focus going on in Darfur, and there's millions of them in parched desert. To give you a sense of what a place like that looks like, it's Justin, he'll read a short excerpt. This is by a guy named Benjamin, who's actually a principal of a local school in one of these camps. He took the job himself a few years ago, and it's, when they say a school, it's a corrugated iron shack with a couple of benches.
How can I describe this place to people who have never been here? It's a simple place. We are mostly from the south. Some are from the Nuba Mountains, and others here have recently come from Darfur. We all get along, even the northerners that have come to live here. Once we're here, we're all in the same situation with the same status, so we get along. There are some small troubles, certainly. Even here, we sit and talk, a Sudanese and a foreigner, and a drunken Arab man has come in and told me I should be ashamed of myself for talking to a white man like this. But these are only small troubles. Besides, how could we have crime? I mean, even if someone wanted to commit robbery here, what is he going to steal? The ground is dry and the air is hot. There's no chance to grow food. We do have water because we have hand pumps donated by organizations. There's no electricity. We build our houses from mud. Right now, it is the summer rainy season, and 2 days ago, a flood came and my house collapsed because it has no concrete foundation. Now I will live with my neighbors until the end of the rainy season, and then I'll build another house. This doesn't happen every year, but it happens when there's a lot of rain. To rebuild, the people in the village come together. For a day or two, all the men in the village come together and make a start on the house, usually building one room and one rakuba, a tent out of plastic sheets. It is a camp of mud and plastic. And later on, I can finish the house and build a wall around the perimeter. That's pretty easy. Just bake some bricks and stack them and stick them together with more mud and sticks. It will take about 7 days to be ready. A woman here will find work cleaning for a wealthy Arab family, and they'll give her a few pounds and some leftover food. Never enough. If the men find work, they can bake clay bricks, or work as diggers, or clean the streets near the markets. Some people go out of the city to work as farmers. People here are below the poverty line, and they receive no care from the government. There are no hospitals here for us, and children can die easily. There are hospitals close by. Just out the school window, we can see a shiny new hospital, only a year old. It's a military hospital, though. It does not belong to us. It's for the retired military veterans and for other rich people who can buy care. But it is not meant for the public. If one of our children is sick, we would have to pay money to get in. And if we don't have money, the child dies. Right now, there are no government schools in Jebel Alia. My salary does not come from the government, and it cannot come from the students. The classes are free because nobody could afford them otherwise. For my work as the principal of the school, I receive 100 pounds, 50 American dollars, for the month from Save the Children UK. In the language of the humanitarian workers, that's not even enough money to call it a salary. They call it an incentive. But 100 pounds a month is still better than many schools. Sometimes there's no money at all, so we have to cut school for almost 2 months, find some other way for the teachers to make money, and then start classes again.
Benjamin, when you're hearing, he's saying that.
Camp for 15 years living, and is actually now thinking about perhaps going back to South Sudan because there seems to be some peace and stability that's there for the moment, but he's still not sure enough, not confident enough in that to go back, so he's taking his, he's still hedging his bets and staying in Jebel Alia camp. And this, these are, again, this is sort of, should bring to mind the picture that we have, the sort of the classic parched earth, plastic sheeting camp. There's another side to it, and I'll just briefly illuminate that one, and then we'll move forward. But so you get another sense. And what we're trying to do here is speak to everybody from folks who are still living in camp situations, or people who have been very recently displaced by the violence in Darfur, to people all along the steppes, to people who are in major urban centers where people often will go to find different types of work outside of the country and hope to get resettled to the United States or to Australia by the United Nations. So one of those is a woman named Awil, who was actually interviewed for the book. And I think we have a photo of her as well. Awil, absolutely sensational woman that I met in Cairo. She was Southern Sudanese also. She was, her village was attacked and most of her family was killed in an attack by the northern government on that village in the 1980s. She escaped by herself as an unaccompanied young girl, and eventually church groups and stuff shuffled her up to Khartoum. She went to a church school there and was sort of adopted by a family who had ties to her family, rather distant ties, back in South Sudan. But eventually she was forcibly married off to a man who abused her terribly, that man she eventually escaped from, went to Cairo where with her two children. In Cairo, she was, in Khartoum she had suffered sexual violence. In Cairo, she was accosted by a group of men and raped, and there was no police protection because Sudanese refugees in Cairo cannot depend on police protection at all. They have basically no tangible legal aid in terms of or rights to healthcare, to education, anything like that. And it's difficult enough for an Egyptian to find work with 35% unemployment in that country. So you can imagine what the men and women are left to do. During one of those searches for work, she was a victim of sexual violence again. And then a third time, she was picked up by two police officers walking home from work that one night, picked up by three police officers, two of which proceeded to rape her. But she said, I'm going to be smart this time. And she told them that she was on her period, so she couldn't have sex with them, that it would be dishonorable for them to have sex with her. She offered them oral sex instead and performed oral sex on them, took a Kleenex and collected their semen samples, and took it to a lawyer who was working with refugees and said, what can we do about this? I got their license plate number. I've been here before. I'm not going quietly again. And she's still in Cairo, even though the Canadian embassy has offered to give her emergency resettlement because they think it's not safe for her there. She's still there fighting one of the first cases to come before Egyptian courts in which judges have admitted DNA evidence. In the midst of that, she was granted an interview for official refugee status by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And
they did not give me a reason.
In November 2002, I got a telephone call to go to the UN High Commission for Refugees. Is that right? Refugees. For my refugee status interview. A man named Ahab interviewed me, and a woman was there. They asked me questions. It was a bit weird because they would ask me a question and then go out of the room. When they came into the room again, they would ask me how I felt after being raped. The entire interview lasted half an hour. I really didn't get to tell them anything. They were not compassionate. When I would cry in my story, they would not comfort me. They stopped and asked if I wanted to move the appointment to another day. I said I just wanted to get it done. They got bored, and the woman would leave and come back again. It ended. I went back in 2 weeks to get my results. I found I was rejected for refugee status. They did not give me a reason. They gave me a month to appeal. I was upset. I wondered why I came to Egypt. Now I was very upset. I think that the laws of the UN High Commission are good, but the people there do not care about refugees. We come from Sudan, and we only know about the UN for help. We go to their office, and the security guards outside treat us like shit. I wrote an appeal in December 2002 and gave it to the UN High Commission office. I received an answer in October 2003 telling me I had an interview appointment for an appeal on May 5, 2004. When May 2004 came, I was working in Alexandria because the family I cleaned for had moved there. I told them I had to be back in Cairo by the 4th of May at the latest. The madam told me she didn't want me to go, and if I wanted to go, I should leave and never come back. I told her to give me my money and that I would go, that the only reason I worked was to support myself while I waited for that interview so I could get away from Egypt. She said no because she didn't want me to leave. I did not have enough money to travel back to Cairo, and I knew nobody else in Alexandria, so I missed my interview. I made it to Cairo 2 days later. The UN High Commission gave me another appointment for June 6, so I was lucky. When I returned on June 6, I found out there was a decision from Geneva. They had stopped giving interviews to all Sudanese. I asked why. They said it was because Sudan now has peace as a result of the Naivasha negotiations. They said to wait until December, and then we would have more news. They gave everyone there a yellow card, which means your case is undecided. Yellow only keeps them from deporting you. When December came, there was no news. At All Saints Cathedral, they had a meeting and said there would be financial aid for yellow card people. I had my three kids, and I needed the money. To get the money, I had to register with Caritas, the Catholic Relief Services. The security outside the building was absolutely awful. None of the clerks inside would come and talk to us. They treated us like wild animals. They said, come back another time. I needed to make money. I gave up.
So, these are the sorts of stories that we wanted to get on the record, if nothing else, over the course of the book. And we were lucky to meet some pretty exceptional individuals who were generous enough to share their stories with us. We took the interviews, transcribed them, and then shaped them into narrative form like you're hearing there, working with the people, the narrators, as much as possible. And I should stop talking or talk less, I warn you. And one of the folks that we interviewed was Panther, who is kind enough to come here tonight from Boston. How's it going, Panther?
It's going well.
So will you talk, just explain a little bit about how you met us at the project, and how did that come about, and what was the actual process like for you of telling your story?
How I actually met the Voices of Witness, I have no idea. I got an email from somebody that I suspected was you, but how you got me, I have no idea. But I have, since I got to this country in 2001, when I was given a chance to speak to a church group, and when we got out, everyone was in tears, and all they told me was that they did not know about a thing that was happening in Sudan and what I went through. So I took it as a mission to actually tell my story. And so by the time you arrived to actually writing this book, I had already spoken to a lot of different people, and probably that's how I got recommended for it. And so that's how Rebecca emailed me and said about, you know, setting up some interviews to tell my story, and that it was going to be collected, you know, like anthology of narratives, and if I were willing to do so. And I said, sure.
So do you want to, before we go any further, give a little taste of what that story is, of where you're coming from?
Well, first of all, in the process of writing, I mean, telling my story, usually I speak to audience, and so I get to say what I want to share with the audience, and based on the level of who I am talking to, whether being high school, middle school, or college, or churches, or temples, you know, I get to share my story based on what I think. But when I sat down with Rebecca, actually doing interviews, you know, asking some of the questions that some of them that I did not expect, it was difficult. It brought back to mind, what I had gone through, and but it was also fulfilling in a way that I knew this was going to be compiled, put together, and have people that could not come to my speaking engagements read them. And so I had level of comfort in that. But my story really started back in Sudan in 1987 when I was just another young, happy child, a boy that was growing up among the loved ones, you know, my relatives, and that knew nothing about the world but just us. You know, that wakes up in the morning to, you know, eat and play, and eat in the evening and play and all that. But in 87, after a civil war that you already spoken about, you know, had it started in 83, but then it was between the rebels and the government forces, and so we really did not even understand what the fighting was. Until in 87 when the government of Sudan realized that we actually were the forces of the rebel. We were supporting, you know, the rebel from the south. The southern Sudanese could not be separated from the rebels because they were the backbone of the rebellion. And so the only way to actually defeat the rebels was to go to the villages, you know, just clear as much as you can so that, you know, they would have no support. And so my village in 87, was attacked, came under fire, was just in a cattle camp. And when the fighting really started and, gunshots and whistling of, you know, the bullets and everything, just like the world was coming to an end, and, you know, saw that, you know, people were scared. For young people that wanted to actually run back to the village for, you know, rescue from their parents, even though the danger was within in the village. People, you know, it's the sense was that you go to your relative, your parents, your whatever, so that you can be safe. But that was actually the point of attack. That was where the attack was coming. And so you saw this confusion, you know, everyone running around, and I saw people that would be our elders later, those that were older than us, telling us to calm down, and that, you know, the more we actually cry, that the more the enemy actually hear us. And so we had to keep quiet, and they console us, they kept us in the bushes.
And when you're saying this, you're saying the elders, the people older, you were about 10 at the time, is that right?
I was about 10, and the elders would be about 15, 17, 18, you know, those that we thought were bigger than us. And so, and they attacked, including the burning of our house and the huts did not stop until way in the night. So at that point they told us to, you know, stick together, follow them, and that they would, you know, take us to safety. And so, you know, we did like they were telling us, and we were following them, and that actually was the beginning of my exodus. That's how I got away from my home. Although they told us that we were just going around the village and that we would come back, but they were actually taking us to what would later on become became Ethiopia. And so we started walking. And people collected as we were going, you know. There, you know, we started as few, like number of, like between 10 to 20 people, and then collection of young people, women, girls, and we were walking towards Ethiopia, and it became like a month and a half journey to Ethiopia. At those points where we would stop, we would be attacked from aerial bombardment, or at nighttime when we were actually walking, you know, it just even from one person hearing an animal jumping, you know, we would just be running into chaos, like we were attacked again, and you know the elders that were with us would go again collecting us back. And it would be, you know, we would settle down. And we arrived in Ethiopia after a month and a half walked. And they told us it was Ethiopia. We were safe, but we could not actually tell because, you know, there was nothing that gave us guarantee that, you know, we were safe and that it was Ethiopia. It was that just another jungle, really. And like I say in the book, the life started really, you know, hard from when people were actually expecting to see their parents. You know, people want to go back home. And some got sick, you know, and the earlier childhood diseases such as measles and whooping coughs and other diseases just broke out, and it was just a mess, you know. There was like contamination, things like cholera, because we could not bury the dead because we were young to actually do the burial. We would be told to, you know, dig in the dirt and, you know, and put the soil on them, but we could not do it deep enough to say that when, you know, the body decomposed, you know, they would just, you know, break the soil. And and it was difficult, you know, really. We live like, you know, tomorrow would be your day that you may not wake up. I remember when, you know, at the time when, you know, you woke up in the morning and you were sleeping together under a tree, like three or four had died from, you know, the disease. And it was just amazing how, you know, we live like you would die tomorrow, you know. And so, but things started about a few weeks or months later. You know, the Ethiopian government came with one truck with medicine and some bags of corn, sacks of corn, and they gave us, and life started improving. UNHCR came with an assessment team, and they went back, brought food where, you know there was plenty in the beginning. And our elders told us that from that point that our life, as you know, we were pastoralists, some of us were farmers, that our life would change completely, and that we would be looking for a different way, and that is to focus on education. And we came up with a term called education is my father and my mother, because we were now separated from those, and what would be our future would be education. They would, you know, sit us under the tree and label the sand and articulate A, B, C, D on the sand, and we would follow that, and that's how really we started. And then not too long after, in 1992, about 1991, about 4 years into our stay in Ethiopia, Ethiopian government fell into rebel, and rebel, that was a group that was friendly to the government of Sudan, and they wanted us out of Ethiopia in 48 hours. you know, and we couldn't do it, you know, fast enough that, you know, they really caught us up with us, and they were just shooting at us, and we were running. We couldn't run fast enough.
When you say us, how many at this point is it?
By that time, we were between 20 to 50,000, you know, just massive number of people in a camp, a refugee camp in Ethiopia. And then we ran back to Sudan, and the Sudanese government heard we were back, and, you know, aerial bombardment started. And so we had to run to northern Kenya, and that took us almost a year. We would stop there for a while until we get attacked again, and we would run. And we arrived in 1992 in northern Kenya, and that where we found final peace. You know, we found a more settlement where we had to settle there for until I got resettled in the U.S. in 2001.
Well, when you say you found some settlement and some peace there, like, what did that look like?
Settlement in terms of stability. But we actually came to northern Kenya that was dry, there was nothing there, it was bare. We had to start the camp. We were the first to start the camp that would later on become like 200 and whatever thousand people. But it initially started with about 16,000, and then it collected. The Sudanese came. The camp was just another dry area. There were only Kenyans from the Turkana. They nomad people. They only keep cattle. And most of the animal they actually keep are donkeys. And when we first came, they were worried we were going to steal them and eat them, but they really discovered that we don't eat donkeys. they let them loose, you know. But yeah, that's how we started. And then UNHCR came with things and built huts. We started building huts, and they constructed schools, and we started going to school. We, you know, the food condition started to be really good. In the beginning, we even had sugar for tea, but then, you know, as time went by, the ratio, you know, really was cut into. I mean, the number of people was increasing, but the ratio remained constant. So we were eating at the same pie, you know. And so by the time, you know, in 1998, 1999, then, you know, food condition was really hard, and some of us, you know, couldn't bear it. You know, some that just wanted to stay, not going to school, but some of us were determined to just use school as the only way you can survive the hunger. You know, you go to school, you read when there is no food, and, you know, that's...
Just to give you a sense, I went to Kakuma in the course of the interviews for this book and spoke to some people, actually spoke to a couple of girls who had been there all of their lives. And still the camp is over 100,000. It's a city. That's just out there in the middle of nowhere in northwest Kenya. And those trees that Panther and folks planted in the early 90s started to sprout, and there's green there now, and the houses are still largely made out of mud and corrugated iron, but they're much more developed than they were before, and people have sunflower gardens, and there's a marketplace using the means of the informal economy. People have been able to bring in cell phone chargers and satellite television so you can watch CNN in a corrugated iron bar where you have beer that's imported from Nairobi, because, you know, over 15 years people are able to develop their... But at the same time, this huge, massive camp full of folks from South Sudan and Burundi and Somalia... it's still sustained largely, like, it's kept alive by virtue of the humanitarian aid industry. It's enormous. and you were there until
2001.
2001.
Yeah, I got resettled in Boston in 2001, March of 2001. into extreme, really extremely cold weather. So I came there, I was given a mentor to teach us how to cook, because we did not know how to cook American food. But I insisted in helping me go to school instead. You know, I told her, you know, what you can really help me with is going back to school, because that's what I think has become my passion, and that's what I think I could do to help back home. Because as time went by, you know, and reading about stories in Sudan, and looking into conflicts, you know, Sudan have had, you know, two conflicts, so civil wars, one from 1955 that and last until 72, and then the one in 83 until 2005. One of the core issues and things that I thought was always the causes of fighting is the level of disparity between the Northern Sudanese and the Southern Sudanese in terms of education. The Northern Sudanese are way ahead in education. They have developed the North. The South was just kind of left behind. And I realized that the Southern Sudanese, when they want to ask for, you know, their fair share in economy, in power, and even recognition of being a citizen, when they want to do that, they could not do it in the parliament because no one is there. No one is educated to do that there. They could not do it in the government because no one is even in the government. And so the only way they could do it was to go back and fight, you know. And I realized, we are not going to be separated that easily. The Sudan is probably going to be loosely connected forever. And the only way you build that fees is probably bringing up the Southern Sudanese so that when they go in the parliament, they are equally confident that they can debate whatever legislation is to be debated in the parliament instead of going back to war. Because at this level, I understand, I am confident, if you sit me with the Northern Sudanese Arab person and ask him why he wants me to be a second-class citizen in Sudan, and I'm sitting there, I don't think he would have an answer that I wouldn't challenge. And so I think education has become a core value that we could use to actually solve Sudanese issues instead of always going back to war. And so I came with that understanding. And when I had the chance to do that in the U.S., I told my mentor, get me back to to school so I could learn more. And she helped me. I enrolled into UMass Boston in 2002, graduated with my BA in 2006, and worked for a year and went back to school. And I'm a graduate student now at Brandeis University doing sustainable international development. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm doing my practicum actually back in Sudan, and will be going back in a week. For 4 months.
So, and when you go back, I mean, this is something I guess we should take a few minutes to talk about. Is tell us a little bit about what you're going back to, what you're going to see when you get there, and what you're looking forward to working on more specifically.
When I went back in September of this year, just over 2 months ago or three, I saw that, you know, first when I went to Juba, there was this incredible amount of, you know, optimism in people's faces. You know, everyone sees that they have the opportunity to develop themselves. And even when I saw that there was no much improvement, they were telling me, look, and I write that in my blogs, they were telling me that, look, a lot have changed. We have seen progress the progress we have seen in 3 years, we have never seen it since 55.
Just to clarify, Juba is the place that you're talking about, is the capital of South Sudan, and since the peace agreement in 2005, the South has had basically provisional autonomy, is the best way to say it, is they have control of their internal infrastructure, and there's an agreement over sharing of oil revenues, another story between the North and the South, but the Southerners have their own government that's running the construction of the country. It's weird to say reconstruction because I think up to 2005 there were a total of 20 kilometers of paved roads in the entire country or something. Mm-hmm.
So I went to the village, different village where my family is, and I found that there was nothing whatsoever, no clean water. No medical facility, no schools, not even the way of life that I fled, from the time I fled, that has improved. There are no cattle. We used to have a lot of cattle. We used to have a lot of goats. This time there weren't any. And the actual structure, like huts that they're living in, are more temporary than what I remember when I fled. And what I sensed and heard from was the level of people were not yet confident about the feast. They're not settling yet because they fear that the Sudanese government may decide at any time to violate the feast agreement, and therefore whatever think you can do for now for progress, can become a loss. And so people are living on, like, they are on the move, on the move. They're not yet settling in the villages. But the government of South Sudan in Juba is doing great job, including with the humanitarian and development agencies are doing great job to actually build that confidence in people. And one of the activities that I'm going for right now is to help that local capacity to be able to understand this is going to be a lasting peace, and hopefully, the international community can also support it until 2011 when the South actually decides on whether to be part of the Sudan or becomes independent. Yeah.
And people are really kind of, this date of 2011, I think, is really looming in a lot of folks' minds. You'd agree?
Yeah.
This is part of the peace agreement, was this agreement that in 2009 there would be national elections for government. How that's actually going to happen when you have a corrupt regime that's running the country and there's never been a census taken before in this country ever is anybody's guess as to how this is actually going to work out. And in 2011, there will be a vote among the Southerners whether or not to secede and form their own country. And going back to oil sharing revenues and resource management and management of the Nile River, you can expect some real tension. You can expect a fight in 2011 if it doesn't go the way that the northern government wants it to go. Is something that really it's going to be a very and something that I think we're not talking about enough over here is looking forward to those dates and thinking, based on the history of how things have gone in the past, this is something to really be looking forward to. But well, I wonder, from your perspective, coming from outside, mm-hmm. And working, being part of that humanitarian aid effort, like, when you look at the situation, you've been in South Sudan recently, mm-hmm. What is it that, do you see what Panther sees?
And, most definitely, yeah. I've actually been twice to South Sudan now, first in January, and now I just got back last week. And you can, even within that short period of time, you can see so much happening. People are slowly coming back to settle in Maban County, which is where we operate, and it's very close to the Ethiopian border. It was a garrison town during the war, and so it was, when we got there in 2006, it was a flattened landscape. There was nothing. There was no basic services, no healthcare, no water, and really no one there. But since this, since January, really, of this year, people have been coming back slowly but surely. And, with other aid agencies, we're helping to develop infrastructure. And I think what we're focusing on most is clean water. But we're integrating that with health as well. But I think, you know, I think you're exactly right. I think to make it sustainable, what we really need is to show that there will be peace or that there will be some kind of investment on all our parts, so that people start taking ownership of their own development. And I think that's one of the things we're grappling with.
Can you like, because that's, I think the key word there is grappling. It's like, what is it, within that term of grappling, like what are the sort of, what does an obstacle look like to success? What are the limitations or obstacles or just impossibilities that you guys are faced with as you're going back and trying to
I think it depends on where you are located in the country. We are in a very remote area, and a lot of what we're seeing is, you know, we have a Ministry of Health for the state, but we're not able to get health staff, for instance, with capacity to work in the county that we work in. So developing capacity internally, but also saying, you know, these are areas that need service. People are coming in from Khartoum and also from Ethiopia across the border. So these are some of the challenges we see is, you know, using, developing capacity within. And a lot of, you know, in the last 21 years, there weren't medical institutes. I mean, there were, but not very many, where we could get trained health personnel, for instance. So I think that's one of our biggest challenges.
And how does that compare, just to sort of tie it in a little bit, from both your perspectives, I'm interested. You see what the state is right now in Sudan, South Sudan, which seems to be a rather tenuous but optimistic moment of of relative stability, and where people are actually talking about building, versus what's going on in the West, in Darfur. How do you see, is it fair to assess, like, and to say, if you want to look at what Darfur is going to look like in 10 years, look at what was happening in South Sudan in 1995,
yeah,
at 10 years into their conflict? Is that where we can see going, what's happening there, and how does that state of affairs in, how do the two situations compare to each other right now? Like, what is the difference in the level that people are at in Darfur right now? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that this is essentially foreshadowing what could potentially happen in Darfur, where there is, you know, if this continues, there'll be, you know, people will leave their homes as there has been doing, and they will come back when eventually there is peace achieved to find absolutely nothing there. So I think in that sense, you know, there is definitely a parallel. And I think, you know, if we let Darfur continue, this is, well, not that if we let Darfur, but if Darfur continues, I think it'll be a lot like what people are coming back to now. Is that what you were getting at, more or less?
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to compare the two scenarios, you know, the Darfur and the South Sudan, you know, one thing that I might want to point out to the audience is that the Southern Sudanese conflict, you know, is more historic. You know, it's been going on for half a century now, and it has always been, you know, so much of the divide. You know, the Southern Sudanese have always had they have always been attached to the sub-Saharan African countries, and they much look like me. But also the major divide during the two wars have always been the belief. And
you mean religion?
The religion, yeah. And so even in the first two wars, Darfurians, who are actually, rightfully African, if you really think of it, really looked deeply into their history, were misled to believe that the Southern Sudanese were just against Islam, which, you know, is their belief. And so they were made to ally with the Northern government and were actually the force against the South. and have committed atrocities were part of the armed groups that came to the South in both in the 70s during that time to during the 80s, but recently into they realized in fact that way they were just being used, and they were not getting the fair share of what they probably wanted to have in the government, and so that's where the rebellion came in. But to really, speak about the nuance of these conditions between the North and the South is that Southern Sudanese were never recognized as citizens in the Sudan. It was so much easier for a Muslim West African to get citizenship in Sudan than it was for the Southern Sudanese. You know, that's how divided the country it used to be. And so, in fact, Darfurian had upper hand to really speak to. Right now, they have become part of the targets because they have started claiming their identity of being African, because it was that if you were Muslim, spoke Arabic and behaved like Arab cultures, you were elevated. You were superior to the infidels, they call them, in the South. And so Darfurian had upper hand until recently when, they began to really see things in details, and realize that it wasn't just about that, it was about representation, it was about, fair share of political economy and some other things altogether.
I was gonna, we'll open up at this point if people have comments or questions to get involved, and we'll kind of go along the way. We'll go ahead, up here in the front, sure.
Panther, first I want to say thank you to you for pointing out that there are hundreds of tribes in the Sudan and that there are hundreds of dialects and that we only hear about a couple of the tribes. Panther, I wanted to ask you, Juba is a Dinka city, and I mean it is the most populous city in the South, but because you've said there are many hundreds of tribes, there are tribes that are your neighbors, and we never hear what has happened to them. We never hear what happens to people that are your neighbors, like the Nuer or the Shaluk. What happened when the South was attacked? What happened to them? And why are there never any spokespeople from any of the other tribes? And if it should happen in the future years that Sudan is partitioned and that the South wins a total independence and Juba is the seat of government, will the surrounding tribes receive fairness from the Dinka, who are dominant?
First, I want to correct something. That Juba is not a Dinka city. It's not in any way in the location of Dinka. It's actually a Bari city. It's also a Kakwa city. The smaller tribes. Juba is not in a Dinka territory, but the government in Juba, is led by a Dinka man who is the president of the Sudan. But there are two governments in Juba. There is a government of Central Equatoria. Central Equatoria is all everything but Dinka. That the Central Equatoria. And so there's no Dinka in that level of government. The government of Southern Sudan, which is the autonomous government, is led by a Dinka man. And the way it came about was actually during the rebellion, when the war started in 83, it was led by a Dinka man. And so, but when you talk about rebellions, you go with people you trust. And people that follow you are people that trust you as well. And so, but a rebellion is something you don't force people into. You go with people that understand the passion and that want to do the job. And so in the beginning, the army, that the rebels that fought, and which actually brought really destruction to the Dinka, were Dinka. You know, the Dinka was a great number of people, and so when the Arab was fighting, they were actually targeting Dinka because the rebellion was seen as Dinka-led. And so although, you know, as the Dinka men were fighting and dying there, the Dinka young children, the women, were attacked as well. You know, that's the way Dinka became the target in the war. The vice president of government of South Sudan is a Nuer. And so, you know, that's another tribe. It's not a Dinka. The Speaker of the Parliament is, I think, Bari. It's a Bari. It's not a Dinka. So that, you know, it's the government is well represented. The army is a lot of Dinka there. I have to be honest, but you know, it was from when people could sacrifice. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, it's probably different from American army because American army is enticed by what you get, but the rebellion is something that you do it with your passion. You don't get paid from it, and you don't get, all you get is destruction. And so there are a great number of Dinka there, but you know, that's how it started. When it succeed, hopefully, when the South succeed, we know that there's going to be Dinka majority, and that's usually, you know, it's a number of people there. There's going to be next tribe, which is Nuer, it's a great number. And there are other tribes. Hopefully they would understand that majority is not a domination, and minority does not mean you have to be equally, get equal cheer with the majority. And I hope that's something we can work out with, you know, with the people that understand the nuances of the Sudan. I hope, you know, that answers your question.
Hi, thank you for coming. If the state of Sudan in its present borders is broken up, if the South were to secede, where do you think that the Darfur area would end up? Do you think it would stay with the North, with the South, or do you think perhaps it would be best for it to perhaps become its own nation state?
It would not be part of the South.
No, it's north, really. Even, you know, it's north. But if the South succeeded, you know, from the whole country, I don't know what will happen, whether the Darfur wants to succeed as well. But, you know, we have one common uniting factor, and that is African identity with the Darfurians. That's for sure something that is there. But everything else, you know, they are not part of the South.
What you should, I mean, you've hit on something, of course, that the people that are running the larger Sudanese government right now are, of course, worried about is the precedent of this, is you're losing South Sudan and of course, oil fields that are there, and then Darfur in itself is a huge swath of land. It's about the size of France, I guess, they say, and contains huge amounts of arable land, and important trade routes and grazing routes go through it. So, yeah, it's of course, going to be a worry. The Khartoum government is saying, if this is happening in the south, it could happen in Darfur, it could happen in East Sudan, where a quiet, sort of low-level war has been going on and on, and just never quite broken into the New York Times, wasn't quite bloody enough to make the cut, but it has been going on low levels in the east for years, and then unionists that are in the north of Sudan, I mean, this could be the first crack that sends everything aflutter, and that's definitely a reason to be watching out. And of course, the Darfurians are looking at the process that's going on between north and south right now and wondering where they fit into that story, or how their next chapter will look.
Thanks for coming. I actually work for the Library Foundation, and I'm actually very grateful for the three of you to be here tonight. I have two questions, actually. The first one will be for Penta. If South Sudan were to become an independent state, is it your opinion that it will be able to achieve a decent level of self-governance and that it will not fall into the Eritrean case, which seceded from Ethiopia in 91 and just became chaos? My second question is for Rhonda. What kind of assistance does Relief International provide to the refugees on the ground? What I mean by this is it a system that's focused on helping those refugees to achieve self-sufficiency, or does it perpetrate a model of dependency towards international aid?
I think I would answer that question in two different parts. First is that, yes, there is a lack of capacity in the South, and it's understandable and probably was brought about the neglect from the government of Sudan. You know, there are very few capable, educated people. If they and those few capable, educated people in the South got their education because they either came to America or Europe or some other places and not from the Sudan. And there are well-equipped universities that, you know, in the north. You go, if any of you had gone to Sudan, there's a guy from my school that told me he's from West Africa, and what they hear there is that, you know, these people that like to kill themselves and whatever, and he went for a peacekeeping mission. First he landed, and he was informed about, you know, the difficulties that he would face in Sudan, and he went to Khartoum. And he said, "Oh, this is not bad. You know, I have been to places like this, and this is actually good." And then he was put on plane to go to Juba, the capital of the Sudan. And so he was coming down, and the pilot announced that, you know, they were approaching Juba, and they were, you know, about to land. And he looked around and couldn't see anything. And he landed down and got out, and he said to himself, "These guys had a good reason to fight." That's how divided the country and marginalized and neglected the Southern Sudan has been. And so, you know, is it reasonable to fear that there's going to be chaos after that because there's less capacity in the South? I don't think that's the case, because the North was not even helping in the first place. And so I think it was trying, you know, I really think, you know. And in fact, from the stories I heard from the people in Juba, that they had, you know, they saw the, you know, great achievement in 3 years, more than they had seen since 55. And so I really don't fear that there is, I mean, there are going to be problems, because it is in the interest of the Northern Sudan to infiltrate. And that's what they're doing from day one. You know, they're buying people, they are sending, you know, militias and do whatever they do. They're going to sabotage the situation. And that's understandable. And so that's not going to be a, you know, hallelujah in the South, but there's going to be problems. But I think South Sudanese are actually anticipating that, and hopefully things will work out.
So I'll try to answer your question basically by giving a global picture of what we do internationally and then coming down to Sudan. Globally, we employ a relief to development approach. We understand that initially we might need to do just very emergency-based life-saving interventions, but we try to do that and evolve our programming into more sustainable work. In Darfur, currently, we operate both in South Sudan and Darfur. In Darfur, we do two sets of activities: emergency interventions, which are mainly health and nutrition, and we operate health clinics and health units in IDP camps and also in villages. We have a predominantly Sudanese-based staff, and we're constantly working on building capacity. But also for our beneficiaries, we work in food security and livelihood sectors. And we try to bring in sustainable agricultural practices. We work very closely with universities to bring in improve irrigation and agricultural techniques of the population within the country. In Darfur, we also do, we've done in the past microcredit, which we are also going to be starting up again in 2009. And that's just to enable our beneficiaries to have a higher degree of self-sufficiency and not just be relying on what we or what another aid agency can provide. For South Sudan, our activities, we've been working with UNHCR on returnee assistance, and that's, you know, just repatriation activities. But we also do health and water. And in both those, we're trying very heavily to engage our local beneficiaries. With water, for instance, we work with local Sudanese contractors to build the borehole, to drill the boreholes. But above and beyond that, we try to make sure the boreholes are constructed with locally available parts. In each community, we go in and we train community water workers who can then maintain those boreholes so that once we leave, it's not going to be defunct. Or, we teach everything from replacing spare parts to testing water to make sure that quality can be maintained. And similarly, for health programs, we try to work mainly with our local staff. We try to maintain a very small expatriate team. I think in 2009 for us, for South Sudan, would be to grow and expand into food security and livelihoods like we have in the north, because I think this is really, it's a critical time to increase the self-sufficiency of the population. We have had, in the areas we work in, we've had more and more aid agencies come in, which has been, I think, extremely beneficial in terms of meeting the needs for basic services. But I think to go beyond that, and I think one of the biggest needs in South Sudan, in where we work, is also offering a sense of protection. And I think that will come as people have, you know, livelihoods, opportunities, and, you know, a more self-sufficient future.
My question's for Craig, actually. I just wondered, during the process of you interviewing people, if you ever faced any opposition because of the fact that you were an outsider?
I didn't see where that question was coming from. I'm sorry. Oh, there you are. I'm sorry. if I faced because I was an outsider. Yes and no, to be honest. From my limited perspective as an outsider, I think the answer is yes and no. You work in Sudan for long enough and everything has to be preceded by those few clauses. The folks that we spoke with were very eager to tell their stories. Like, if we got to the point where they were going to sit down with me and a microphone and many cups of tea and bars of chocolate for 10 hours and really go through this with a fine-tooth comb and open up and tell their story, then at that point they were quite eager to do it. And once they saw that we were really interested in them as a person, of course, we were lucky enough that people opened up and told us extraordinary details and extraordinary stories. That's within the context of it itself. And I think that it helped me because when I was coming back to work on the book, I had been in Egypt and in Sudan before. When I went to Kenya, I went with Valentino for a while, and then he introduced me to his friends who were in Kakuma, who remembered Valentino from the time they were there. And what they do, what is, you know, funny-looking little white kid knows my neighborhood in Khartoum and can, like, sit in Cairo and talk about our neighborhoods and where the hospital was or where the school was in what neighborhood. And, like, that was often something that would just break the ice enough that people were able to open up. And also, I was being introduced by people that said, you can trust this one, sort of thing. Now, there were certainly problems, and getting into the country and getting out of the country and being discretionary about that. And we were very careful, for example, in Khartoum, even the areas outside in that neighborhood was like, if we were going to sit down with somebody for hours, then like it would be at a neutral, like a discreet location, and we wouldn't arrive at the same time, and there would be other things that were going on, you know, people that were that I was working with, and they were doing other things at the same time, so it wouldn't look like people in the neighborhood would see, hey, that woman went in and just spoke with that white guy for 8 hours. What's she doing in there? Sort of like taking care to use utmost discretion with those sorts of things. But generally, people were amazingly welcoming to me and helpful. You find the right folks, and they always say, like, the people of Sudan are far wiser than their leaders, and that was definitely the experience that I had.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.